All right, let's get started. Good morning. Good morning. Thank you. Hope you all got a chance to see the keynote and especially Scott Guthrie's introduction to Azure. I know it's like a 5-10 minute thing, but any early reaction on what you saw? Nice. Okay, that's good. Actually, we were both very excited to be here because it's been about 6 months that Scott joined Windows Azure, and I joined and I'm work for him, so he's my boss. If you meet him, say good things about me. But more importantly, you know, a lot of things have changed and a lot of things are new. And you know, we're just excited to be here to just share what's on the roadmap, what's there today, and how you can get started with this. So with that, I'm currently Banand. I'm a group program manager on the Windows Azure team. I used to earlier work on what used to be called App Fabric, caching, service bus, you know, high-level middle-tier services, but now I'm working on the core platform. And what we're going to do in the next 65-ish minutes, and I'll keep 10 minutes for Q&A, is we want to walk through some foundational concepts of Windows Azure. And somehow this clicker needs to figure out how to work. Probably just skip that. Okay. We're going to do three sessions, three foundational sessions of Windows Azure. Scott's going to be back at 1:15 this afternoon, and he's going to talk about how do you get started. And that's about everything from how do you sign up, how do you learn about what's available with Windows Azure. If you've never, ever used Windows Azure before and don't even understand what cloud computing is, that's another great session to start with to understand how do you sign up, how do you get started. If you don't use Visual Studio, if you don't use .NET, you know, what the other story is, and I'm sure he's talked about Node and other support as well. And tomorrow, I'm going to do another session, which is a level 300, and we go deep into Windows Azure monitoring, managing day-to-day. But this session is going to be mostly about core concepts that you need to understand everything from what cloud computing means, as well as what's specific to Windows Azure and how do you use it when you're developing applications. So think of this as first year in school. This is how you're going to start with basic concepts. So if you just take away a few of these nuggets, it'll help you, you know, with the other sessions that are scheduled for Windows Azure as well. So with that, this is what I was planning to, you know, talk through. But before I, you know, figure out how much time I should spend, how many of you use Windows Azure today? Not a whole lot. Great. So actually, in a way, it's good because then I can pretty much all the content in this slide deck is going to be relevant to all of you. But at the same time, it kind of hurts that not too many people use Windows Azure today. Hopefully, I should be able to change that. And if there's one goal I have is once you're done with this, you should be able to go get started and build your first Hello World application pretty quickly. So let's start with why should you care about Windows Azure? You know, what's it about cloud computing that makes it relevant? And what is the cloud? There's a lot of general resistance to the notion of cloud, everything from privacy, I don't know what's going on. So what I want to do is I want to go take a quick peek on what really is cloud, what's inside it. It's no different than, you know, you running your own data centers, but with different economics for sure. So let's just step back for a minute and see, you know, why cloud computing makes sense and hence why you see every big company rushing to cloud computing. And for those of you who've typically built applications, deployed them on servers, you know, whether it's one extreme of building a simple mobile application where you could have 10 users today, it could be 10,000 users, a million users in a week, or if you're building a more traditional line of business application or you're building a website, somewhere in between, one of the typical things you would do is you build the application, you make an assumption on how many people are going to use it, do some capacity planning, and push the bits out. So you could be in one end of the spectrum, which is, it's a simple app. I'll probably buy one server, and that's good enough. And all of a sudden, you're successful. Server's on its knees. You start losing customers. You start losing users. The other extreme, and that's what we see most of the enterprises do, is you prepare for the worst-case scenario. So let's assume you build a simple application to do accounting. You know, throughout the year, it hardly gets used or gets used moderately, but then comes the tax season, and a lot of people start using it. And of course, you possibly can't have your site go down at that point. So what you do is, as an enterprise, you buy all the capacity you can to prepare for the worst case scenario, and then hence, you always over-provisioned. And typically, you know, the usage is never static. So What cloud lets you do, essentially what cloud, forget about Windows Azure for a moment or any of the other clouds, essentially what cloud in its core means, it's a on-demand and elastic platform where you don't have to worry about where the hardware comes from, where the capacity comes from. The capacity and the provisioning of this capacity follows as close as possible to what you need. That's pretty much what cloud is. Now, there are different ways to sell the cloud, different ways to talk about it. We're going to get that in a moment. Essentially, what cloud means, everything is dynamic, everything is agile. The hardware, the compute, the servers, networking, the whole stack should follow what your compute needs are, as opposed to either over-provisioning or under-provisioning. So if that's the case, then why are there so many different cloud offerings? So let's just first understand the kind of applications people typically build, and hence, you know, what kind of cloud offerings make sense. Hopefully, you know, all, I'm assuming everyone's a developer here, no IT pros, right? So most of your applications will fit into one of these four categories, and or, of course, there's a dev and test environment scenario as well, which is you build something, you try it out, there's a long period of inactivity, and then you start again, which is what we like to call simple inactivity period. The second category is, and that's what we hope all to be, which is you start building a simple application and it takes off. And it grows really fast, way faster than you can add capacity or you can actually react to re-architecting your application. The other one, as we talked about, is the unpredictable bursting. You know, back in US, last weekend we had the Super Bowl, which is probably the biggest ever event. So what happens is whoever has that special halftime advertisement slot, their capacity requirements just go like berserk. So most sites crumple at that point, which is unpredictable. Kind of predictable, you gave the ad, so hopefully you should have capacity, but then sometimes more people click on your ad than others. But that's very unpredictable. The last one is what we talked about, which is the accounting application, which is predictable. You know it's the tax season, and hence you do need to increase the capacity before everyone starts either filing the taxes or filing the expense reports. So these are typical usage patterns that we see, and if your cloud, if your application fits into any one of these four categories, cloud does make sense to you. And cloud makes sense for you, if nothing else, just pure from an economics perspective. And of course, as we'll see through the rest of the session today, it also makes sense from agility and how your developer productivity goes up pretty significantly. So if that's what you're building, the number of cloud offerings can vary significantly from everything from people just selling data center capacity to you, which is also, hey, you don't have to buy hardware, you don't have to buy data center capacity. Let me just give you a whole bunch of machines when you need them. That's what's typically called the infrastructure being offered as a service. And, of course, the best-known case for that is Amazon, where you never have to buy hardware. You never see networking, you never see storage. All you see is a website where you walk in and you ask for 30 servers, 50 servers with, you know, 2 gig network capacity or terabyte of storage. And what happens is, you know, automatically Amazon data centers carve out that capacity and give it to you. So essentially, you get the servers, which are virtual servers, and virtual storage and virtual network all allocated to you on demand, which is great because you don't have to worry about either buying too many servers or hardware or too less. You can keep adding that on demand. And of course, in addition to Amazon, there are a whole bunch of other players in this, which is VMware trying to offer a lot of through, you know, private cloud as well as public cloud. The second category, which is slightly higher level, is what's called the platform being offered as a service, where not only is the fact that, hey, you have to buy hardware, or don't have to buy hardware, even the notion that you buy virtual servers or virtual machines gets very abstracted from you. So you don't have to worry about installing Windows, installing Linux, doesn't matter what operating system you use. Even the basics of how software gets installed, managed, databases get installed, is completely abstracted from you. You don't have to worry about that. All you care about is the application logic or the business logic. And that's taking, you know, one level higher. So you went from hardware to virtual, from virtual to just an application platform. And as developers, as much as we can avoid ever having to deal with the you know, rebooting machines, installing patches, that's a category that makes it very, very compelling to start using platform as a service. And of course, the third and the most commonly used category for cloud, and like we've all been using cloud. I mean, it's not that cloud is new, honestly. I mean, anyone who had a Hotmail account 15 years ago, you've used cloud, or you use cloud even today. Gmail is the same thing. You know, whoever offers you watch YouTube, video on demand, that's all cloud. So the whole notion of cloud is something new or cloud is something scary, not so true. In fact, it's kind of ironic. If you're ready to put our email, which usually has most of the sensitive data, we're usually skeptical about putting applications which do a lot less. So it's not that cloud itself is scary. It's the notion of how much control do you give over at different layers that's really the big stumbling block. So that's the spectrum at which you can get any of the cloud offerings from different vendors here. So with that as a background, let's understand why people choose certain cloud offerings over others. And it's all about how much control do you want. That's what it boils down to. And of course, with control comes cost. Not as much about buying hardware cost or manage. It's mostly a management and overhead cost that comes with control. So the more people you need to manage, the more people you're spending in doing things which can get automated by software. And of course, the efficiency goes up, but then there are a class of scenarios where it makes sense to actually own that own that hardware. For example, you have a legacy application which only requires a certain set of software that you have to configure, you have to manage. Absolutely, it makes sense to use an offering like infrastructure as a service. If you're buying or if you are running a top secret government project, you don't even want cloud. You just want to have a whole bunch of different standalone servers. So it's not that one is better over the other. It's really a question of how much efficiency do you want versus how much time and cost you're ready to spend on managing the base infrastructure. So that's what the spectrum is, and people will choose depending on the application they need, the level of sophistication, the level of need to spend and control. So just to illustrate that point real quick, typically as a developer, if you're using infrastructure as a service, it's pretty powerful. You go, you get a bunch of VM images, but then first thing you have to do is you have to pick up a virtual machine from a library, install it, install the operating system. Maybe some of them come pre-provisioned with the operating system. Then you install something like, let's say, SQL Server to get a database up. Same thing, you would then go get a couple of more virtual machines, and then you install your operating system, the web server if you're running IIS or Apache, web server of choice. And then, as the next step, you start installing my actual tables that I need for my database, my schema, the things that I really care about from a business logic, and similarly, my application. So it's the fourth step is when you actually get to the point of being able to drop my first Hello World service in this model. And of course, the most complex piece, when you start scaling up and you can start becoming successful, how do you do load balancing? How do you have hundreds of thousands of users hitting your application, whether they're doing simple checking their scores on phones or they're actually building a line of business application? Configuring network and load balancers is the interesting challenge. And it doesn't stop just there. It's not one time. It's every day the time you spend to manage the infrastructure, to manage the various moving pieces here. Let's contrast this real quick with what you'd have to do in a platform as a service offering. In platform as a service offering, essentially, the two big boxes or three big boxes you see from, let's say, a database service, a compute service, and networking is already pre-managed for you. It's already automated. Hence, as a developer, what you care about is, let's install the table schemas that I care about, probably be populated that with real data, and push my application bits over to the machine. Of course, what you lost in this case is you've lost the ability to customize your machines, your pre-installed software. You get some ability, but not a whole lot. But then that's pretty much it. You don't have to worry about setting up networking, setting up firewall rules, none of that stuff. So what is Windows Azure in this context? So going back to the slide we just saw, the best way to understand Windows Azure today is whatever it takes to abstract IaaS, infrastructure service, which is my machine install, my software install, my networking, that glue is now what's called the cloud operating system is essentially Windows Azure. So that as developers, you never have to worry about how hundreds of thousands of servers get provisioned, managed, capacity, networking. That's taken away. So that's what we've built as Windows Azure as a base platform. In addition, Windows Azure is also about providing other application building blocks, as we like to call them. And that's probably the demo you saw Scott building, which is you start using other easy-to-use blocks like, hey, I want access control, I want people to log in, I want messaging, I want to be able to connect to my on-premises. And a whole set of those ecosystem of services is what the building block services we offer in addition to the core operating system. So the best way to think about it is, if you use the Windows servers, the kernel is what the fabric is, and then higher-level services like web services is what the building block services would be. So in a nutshell, that's all that Windows Azure really is. Think of it as a giant operating system managing multiple large-scale data centers for you. So you probably saw the slide from Scott, and of course you're going to see the slide again and again, because in a nutshell, this is what Windows Azure boils down to. It is a system, you know, like all true cloud systems, it is usage-based. So it totally depends on how much you want to use. So you don't have to deal with either under-provisioning or over-provisioning. It's capacity on demand, and you get charged and billed based on usage. It's completely automated, so you don't have to deal with either ever seeing a hardware or a software, you know, virtual machine. And more importantly, all the automation is run as a managed set of resources. So we'll see that in a few demos that follow, that all, you know, things like basic things like scale up, scale down, automation, patching is all managed for you, so you don't have to worry about managing any of the resources that you consume. Of course, to make sure that your business can depend on this, it's an always-on, always-up running service. It has a global footprint. We do offer 99.95% SLA for uptime. So it's guaranteed, and we spend all our energy and time to actually make sure it's always up and always running when you deploy your application in it. And we'll get into the elastic nature when you see some demos about how you can quickly scale up, scale down to meet your customer demands. And if nothing else, as I mentioned, just from a pure buying a server, managing a server, economics perspective, cloud, and especially Windows Azure, makes a lot of sense. And I'll save the public and the private part of the second half of the talk, which is it's not only about building it in the public cloud, it's also about having symmetry with the applications you've built today that you're already building on-premises, and how you bring them to public cloud and bring them back. And we'll see through a few demos that most of the code that I'm going to use is no different than how I would build the application if I was building on a typical web server today. It's just that, in addition, I get some capabilities of being able to dynamically scale out. That's what's unique to Azure. But then we still want to strongly keep the eye on the ball, which is if you're making an investment once, as a developer to build an application, it can easily translate between your public cloud and the private cloud. So with that, I'll take a quick detour and show you what's really inside the so-called cloud. So first thing, of course, there's not one cloud. There are a lot of clouds. So it's like Seattle. That's where we come from. There's a lot of clouds everywhere, which means there's a whole bunch of global data centers. A lot of them are green, which means you're not only saving money, you're also saving world and Earth by using cloud computing data centers, so it's one good deed for the day. So if you just use Azure, you can check that box as well. Just kidding. But more importantly, it's a global footprint. It's a globally managed service. And of course, we've had a strong history for the last 20-odd years running services like MSN or Hotmail at global scale, so it kind of follows the same pattern, where it's not just sitting in North America or US, a whole bunch of presence in Europe, a bunch of presence in Asia, Australia. So you pick your geo that you care about. Of course, there are notable countries which are not here for legal reasons, but other than that, it's pretty much everywhere you need to serve your end users. What's inside that data center is essentially a whole bunch of wires, a whole bunch of hardware, and of course, a lot of power. And this is what really a data center inside looks like. It's nothing very fancy. It's not very something very cool to look at. The good thing is, you never have to see this ever in your real life. So you don't care about what's inside. It's just a whole bunch of wires. It's awesome, but apart from showing good pictures, it doesn't add a whole lot of value because you shouldn't have to deal with this. And I think Scott probably will show you a fancier video of how this thing looks like, and they have fancy containers so you can add more capacity, remote capacity, but It just adds for coolness factor. There's not a whole lot you can do with this. This is the interesting part. What's really going on inside this? Think of a data center as hundreds and hundreds of thousands of machines all stacked up as what we like to call them racks. So each rack has a big set of capacity available, and on top of each rack is a switch. So make sure that all your network gets routed correctly, and hundreds of those racks get connected under a load balancer, and all these load balancers get aggregated eventually at the data center level router. Why is this interesting? The big part to really take away, even though you never have to deal with this, is the fact that it's still a shared service. Yes, you do get dedicated virtual machines, you get dedicated virtual servers to deal with, but in a sense, you're still looking at one data center across hundreds of thousands of users. So keep that in mind when you're designing a service so that you know how to deal with networking, how to deal with the fact that it still will be a shared service, and how you do load balance. But other than that, this is just makes a pretty picture again. It's not something that you would have to go deal with. And if you go deeper into the data center cluster, this is, you know, think of this as if you're building a Hello World application, you don't care about understanding how the kernel works. But if you're really building a large-scale, super computer-intensive application, it's just good to understand how cluster resources work, how Fabric Controller, which is the kernel of the application. So I'm going to quickly gloss over this. I don't want to put you to sleep. The interesting thing to take away from all these few slides that I talked about is, if you're used to what, you know, the on-prem traditional computing used to be, there used to be the server had just blown up, and server essentially is now a data center. That's the amount of compute capacity available to you. What used to be Windows kernel is now the Windows Azure's Fabric Controller. That's the fancy piece which does, you know, kernel used to do the memory allocation, disk allocation. The Fabric Controller does all the allocation about who gets how many servers, when they get it, how they get load balanced. So that's the equivalent compute part. And on top of that are applications that you would build. Things like Word, more enterprise application like SQL Server, or a website, doesn't matter. Similarly, you can build large scaled out services, including some of our own services like Office 365, can now build on top of this massive capacity. So that's an analogy to keep in mind, because you will hear a lot about the Fabric Controller. All that essentially is the heart of the cloud operating system, which does all the allocations for you. So with that, trust me, no more concepts that you now deal with. Let's deal with what's, as developers, you can do with Windows Azure. So before we build an application, a fundamental shift in philosophy is, you know, when you're building a cloud application is, we used to buy big servers earlier. You know, you want 100 users to 10,000 users, you just buy a bigger box. You know, at some point, people start making bigger boxes, kind of gets pretty expensive. And that's one thing as a developer you need to keep in mind and be very thoughtful about. To add more capacity, your application needs to scale out, not scale up. Okay, that's one core concept of cloud computing in general you should be aware of is, it's not about making one box bigger. Because at some point, you cannot be able to make one box bigger enough to, let's say, run Facebook or Twitter. At some point, you have to start adding more redundant capacity, and that's called scale out. So one shift from cloud computing is going to force everyone to rethink their general design philosophy is, how do I not require larger machines, but just more of the same machines? That's essentially scale out. The benefit of doing that is not only you get more capacity, but you also get redundancy. If you know, you just get more units, one unit dies, it doesn't matter. That's essentially how every large-scale company runs their data centers. They don't design it for all hardware to always be available. Hardware just dies, and you should just assume hardware dies. That's what Azure helps you with. We assume hardware is going to die, and scale out gives you the level of redundancy so that you never see an application downtime. The third most critical piece is the fact that you have so many moving parts or so many pieces in your application. The communication between all these components will essentially be asynchronous. And that's one place where, you know, when I do this talk, see most applications, is that in a tightly coupled old world, which is, you know, most components used to run on one server, it's okay to do asynchronous synchronous computing because one process goes down, is typically happens when the machine goes down. Here, each part can go down independently, and it's okay for it to go down. That's the whole point. It's okay for pieces to fail, because pieces will come back, and as long as your application is both asynchronous as well as does retries, your application will scale well for a cloud compute environment. And then, of course, we'll see more of this, which is the more you make your application stateless, and what that essentially means is you keep externalize your state to a durable store, your application can, you know, your service can die, you would not matter. Your machines, your applications can crash, it doesn't matter. The state is always external, and the fabric controller will keep bringing up your machines, keep bringing up your applications, so you never have to worry about a lot of restart logic, a lot of you know, ability to hydrate a state. So if this is the Bible of cloud computing, if these principles is what you can keep in mind, you can pretty much build any application from a simple I check in when I walk into this conference room to building a service of scale Facebook. So essentially, these are the five principles, six principles it all boils down to when you're building a large-scale application. So I'll give a printout of this cheat sheet to everyone at the end of it if you want. But if you look at what the architecture it translates to, most applications, most of the good design today already does this. It's not something fundamentally unique, but there's always this whole notion of a front end. This is my website. This is my simple web service, which is serving end user requests. And then there is the back end tier, which actually does all the processing. And it could be simple processing, like I just take images, create thumbnails. That's a sample I'm going to walk you through. Or it could do something heavyweight, like doing fancy workflows or doing video encoding, or it could be doing DNA compute. Doesn't matter. The point is there's an external world face to your application, which is the front end. And there is the worker tier, which does all the heavyweight processing, but does not need to talk to the external world. And then, of course, the most important part of my application, which is the data. The data is external. And that's the principle we want to stick to, which is in your compute boundary, wherever you're doing computation, make sure the data stays external. Of course, you can always have cache, you can have local storage, that's all available. But what's really critical is any data that you want to get preserved, just keep it to an external storage, and the rest of it we'll manage. What that means is you don't have to worry about a server going down and data being lost. You don't have to worry about a data center going down and data being lost. We manage everything from replication, geo-redundancy, failover, compliance, all that's taken care of, as developers, you keep your data external from your compute nodes. Because compute nodes will keep going down, and your data should not be lost. And of course, from the outside in, there's a whole bunch of either HTTP or HTTPS requests coming in, which gets managed through the load balancer. That's something that we take care of. You don't have to worry about it. But this one simple picture makes up the architecture for most applications. There are simple nuances. Sometimes you don't have a front end. Maybe all you want to do is just a lot of processing. That's fine. Sometimes you only have front end. It doesn't matter. But in a nutshell, this is what can capture the architecture for most applications that get built today. Okay? So with that, let's actually jump in and build a cloud application. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a very simple application to talk about these basic concepts. And all it does is it takes an image, generates a thumbnail, and shows you a thumbnail. So nothing too fancy from complex logic, pretty simple. Surprisingly, since we put the sample out, this has been downloaded like 100,000 times because the number of applications which now let you upload images is just crazy. So apparently a fairly used sample just because there's heavy inflow of pictures and the need to generate thumbnails based on that. But the core characteristics of this application is we want to make sure it's highly available, so that whether I'm uploading my picture from mobile device, my PC, it doesn't matter. I don't want to give a 404 to anyone. It's very important. Second important part is it's my existing simple ASP.NET. We don't want to relearn how to write code. We've all spent enough time learning that. The third piece, which is important, you'll see that with most applications, which is there's a lot of load during some time. There's very little load at other times. Hence, you cannot block your website just because of how many images it's processing. The image processing part, to generate thumbnails or doing encoding, doesn't matter what it is what needs to be decoupled, and needs to scale out independently. So how many users who sign in is completely independent of how many images. Images could be tens of millions, doesn't matter. Number of users are independent. So that's the important part of the application. So I'm going to stop showing the slides at this point. So what I have here is I've got the Windows Azure SDK installed. And before actually I walk you through code, let me just do a quick show you what the application actually does before I really do anything with it. Of course, I'm running this locally. We'll push this up to cloud real soon. It's my most awesome image thumbnail generator service. Pretty simple. Anyone who did anything more than MVC applications can see a better app. But all it does is, if you have a preference, you can pick an image. It picks an image, and when I submit this, it essentially uploads the image from a browser, creates a thumbnail, and shows a thumbnail. So pretty simple logic here. Take a large file, upload a large file, keep it around, generate a thumbnail so I can quickly show it here. So let's see what's really going on under the covers for this one. So first thing you will notice is I've created a simple solution, and I've added a new... Actually, you know what? Let's do this. Actually, rule number one of doing coding on stage is never go away from the script, but I want to walk you through what it actually does, takes to create a new Windows Azure application. All I've done is I've done a new app of type cloud app. Let's call it the TechTays demo. I hope it works. Oops. This is my second round. And I'll pick a simple web role. That's my front end. I'll pick a worker role, which basically does my back end processing. That's pretty much what it is. Let's give it some more friendly names. This is my front end. And this is my back end. And what you'll see here is three things getting created. Of course, my actual ASP.NET project, which is the front end, the back end, which is the worker role, and more importantly, a simple package which defines what the end-to-end application looks like. That's the TechDays demo one. And all it's doing is it's capturing, in a sense, what does my application consist of in terms of the web roles, the worker roles, all the various compute pieces. And because it's a Windows Azure project, it adds a couple of references. So you can use Windows Azure diagnostics, runtime, storage, so on and so forth. And that gets automatically generated for you. But other than that, it's nothing different than building your ASP.NET application today. So with that background, let's just see what I have here for the thumbnail generation application. Similar, simple project that defines I have a web role, I have a worker role, and let's see what's inside each of those roles. For the web role, I just have a very simple default .aspx. It's what we're seeing now. And for the worker role, let me walk through that real quick. Piece of code is essentially doing the thumbnail generation. So one of the first things you see on my web role is it has essentially the same construct that you do with on-prem programming. The new things are there's an availability of a blob storage. So if you're doing regular file I/O today, you write to a local C drive, D drive. Instead of doing that, we write it to a blob store, which is an external state. In addition, we have a queue, which is very important to do asynchronous messaging between my web and the backend. I could have directly called the worker role at an endpoint, but that kind of makes it moot from a perspective of being able to scale it up independently. Other than that, apart from creating it, all I've done is once I, on the submit button that I just clicked, it picks up the image, copies the image to the blob store. So I want to make sure that the images people are uploading, they don't get lost. And the only thing as a developer I have to do is make sure that once the image is uploaded, it's written to the blob store. That point onwards, that image is forever available till you delete it. Whether the data center goes down or the server goes down, you never have to deal with it. We make sure it's geographically replicated and has three copies and all that goodness. But other than uploading it, there's not a whole lot I did. Once the web page is done uploading, the interesting part is I send a message, and you'll see this pattern in most of the samples we push out. All I'm doing is, at the end of the upload process, I'm sending a message that says, hey, a new image has been uploaded. Whoever's available next, please start creating a thumbnail for it. And that's what decouples my entire front end, which can run only, let's say, on three web servers, from my back end, which can run on hundreds of servers. Just the fact of I can send a message between the two takes care of decoupling and doing most of the asynchronous messaging. And that's pretty much it. The last line I've written, because if I need to debug it right now, at least have some basic traces. But other than that, that's pretty much what the web front end does. And of course, once I upload and have the thumbnail available, all I'm doing is I'm iterating over the list of thumbnails available and showing them on the web page. That's just a regular image. So on the website, all I've done is simple submit button, upload the file, keep it. Now let me show you what's inside the worker role. This is where the backend computing is happening. And you know, we'll walk through the different constructs of what's in the on start, why this makes sense, but ignore that for a moment. Let's concentrate on what's really happening. Apart from initializing the connections to the blob store in the queue, the first thing this is doing is essentially gets into an infinite loop, if you will, and just keeps waiting till a message shows up. So this is essentially just creating, let me just walk through here. So the first thing it will do is it will keep listening on the message queue it just initialized and says whenever a message comes up, and any of the workers, so you could have hundreds of these worker roles, could be one, it doesn't matter. All they're doing is they're all listening to the same queue. As soon as the web front end says, I have a message, it picks up the message. In the message, you get the path for the blob storage image. And at that point, all I'm doing is I'm just changing, reading it to memory stream, converts it to a JPEG type, and creates a thumbnail. So six lines of code, read the message, go fetch the file, bring it to memory, create a thumbnail, write it back into the blob store. So that's all that my backend worker is doing. And what we've done is we've been able to tie these things, both these things together with the ability to send messages between my web and the worker role. Now, the other parts of what really defines that this is an Azure application is what's captured in these CFG files and CSDEF files. So let's just quickly walk through this as well. So this is probably the most base version of what a configuration file would look like. And all it's defining are some base parameters. The most interesting one right now is the instance count. And this is what specifies how many machines I want to run this on. You can specify this when you're developing. You can, of course, change it during runtime, and that's what gives you the elastic scale. Other than that, I've made a few other things, which is I'm going to use a certificate to do remote desktops. I can debug if I need to. But other than that, that's all the configuration I had to go do on this base application. And the last piece is my actual service definition itself. And this is interesting. This one is the part where we talk about what are all the endpoints I need to expose. So for my web role, I need to expose an HTTP endpoint so that my website can load, people can go look at the website itself. And for the worker role, there is no equivalent. So you can only see this for the web role. Worker role has absolutely nothing because the worker role never needs to talk outside the data center. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind. The inputs and the endpoints is what defines, in a sense, the security of the application on who can talk to it, whether it's open to the public, whether it's open internally only. And when it's open to public, do you care about HTTP? Do you care about HTTPS? So that's what gets defined in the service definition. So this, in a sense, makes up your application. We'll quickly deploy this in a second, but let me summarize this for you real quick so that this is what's called the Windows Azure service model. And that defines an application. The service model, the way to think about roles, and we added one web role and worker role, is if you're used to building traditional applications, there used to be a concept of a process. Process essentially maps to a role. A little bit different in the sense that the role runs in its entire isolated virtual machine. So this role can be like really, really big role and big process. But other than that, it's essentially just a process with its own boundary, with its own security, with its own threat safety. You don't have to worry about that. The other interesting thing in parallel to processes it defines very clear entry points. That's what we did when we were looking at the endpoints, which is I define a contract on who can talk to me and using which language. So you can pick between different protocols, HTTP, TCP, whatever you want, and you specify which ports you listen to. And in that sense, you can get to define your own entry points. The last interesting part is the number of instances matter, and we require you to have at least two instances if you want the 99.95 guarantee, because one machine can always die. But when you use two machines, we have a lot of smarts in the fabric controller to make sure that we do the right placement, and we're going to walk through some of that fancy stuff in a bit. We can guarantee 99.95 availability just by having two instances of these processes as opposed to one. But this essentially captures what an application is for Azure on top of what you're already used to building. And as we just quickly looked at the service definition files, essentially what we did was we defined the two roles and we picked some interesting parameters such as, hey, I want my front end to be of type web, because it's going to be serving content to the through the web front end. And I want a virtual machine size. You get to still pick your size. Of course, you don't, this is kind of contrary to what I said earlier, which is you should not scale up, you should always scale out. We still understand that you need to write some processes which require more memory than others. So you can go pick the sizes from small, medium, large to extra large, but then extra large is where it stops. So you really cannot write a supercomputer app running on one machine. But other than that, that's what the size gets used for. It defines an endpoint, which is I just want one external endpoint, which is listening on HTTP for the web role. On the middle tier role, the backend role, I don't want an external endpoint. In fact, I want to secure it. So if you're doing any processing which you don't want end users to be able to directly access, please keep the endpoint as internal. Other than that, I will not walk you through update domains and fault domains for the next 5 minutes. We'll get back to them in a second. And for the web role types, this is what's there today, which is the web role essentially is just a server running pre-configured IIS7 for you, and has ASP.NET. So you don't even have to install the web servers. Web server is pre-configured. Of course, if you need to run your own custom web server, you can always take a worker role and inject your own binaries. So you can always do that. And that's what the worker role is. It can run any arbitrary code, and you have full admin permissions. That's one big change since last year. On the worker role, you have a full admin permission, so you can pretty much install whatever software you want. You're running in admin mode, as well as you can remote desktop. So for all practical purposes, it gives you the flexibility of infrastructure service, but the machine is yours, which means you can always shoot yourself as well. So be very careful of what arbitrary code you put. If you install a lot of custom software, it makes the debuggability a lot harder. But if you really want control, you can always put any arbitrary code that you want in here. And what we also saw real quick was that your application, apart from your actual ASP.NET code, is defined by two pieces of information, service definition and a service configuration. The definition plus configuration can both be packaged into a CSP AKG. You'll see that. And that's what you hand over to Windows Azure. So let's do this now. We'll come back to it in a second. This application that I just built, and we just saw it running in locally. By the way, that's one other thing. You get a full local simulator, so you don't have to keep building and pushing the application to Azure. You can install the local compute emulator. Actually, let me show that to you once again. And the compute emulator is pretty smart. It is able to mimic all the behavior of scale-out just by running locally. So, for example, it spins up the two web roles and work roles, and depending on the number of instances you want, it actually starts spinning up instances. So if you actually see the instance, it's a full machine running locally on your dev box itself. And if you remember the analogy I gave you, a role essentially is a process. That's exactly how it's implemented when you're doing local debugging as well. Whatever's running a full role here is actually running just as a process boundary. And when it goes to Azure, it runs in the full virtual machine. But you get a benefit of this local compute emulator. You can do all your debugging, local development before you need to push anything up to Azure. Let's stop this and the last step we'll do is I'll push this to Azure. So let me walk you through a few simple steps. Pick the subscription, and Scott's going to walk you through how to create a subscription. It's pretty easy. He's going to start from native app. I pick the name of the service that I want to call it, the environment, because I'm still developing. Let's just put it in staging. And the ability to configure a few things like, yes, I want a remote desktop. So that's one big thing that helped, you know, there's a lot of feedback when we heard last year, which is, you know, once you push the application up to Azure, you should be able to debug it. You get full remote desktop capability. You can directly remote desktop, look at the local logs, local server characteristics. So you can just enable that through Visual Studio itself. So you don't have to do anything fancy. And that's pretty much it. And then through Visual Studio, you can publish your application to Azure. And what it's going to do is, of course, it's going to build it first and start pushing the bits up to Azure. Let me switch real quick and show you the management portal side of it. So this is the Windows Azure management portal. And what you've seen is I've already created one. I want to make sure that I had a working version of the application running in Azure. I can always trust the demos to work. So I have an existing version of the application running. And I've pushed another copy. You'll see that show up in a second. And this mimics exactly the structure that we saw on the local compute emulator, which is I have one web role and I have one worker role. And this is what makes up my application. And when I look at what the application is doing, I can browse this. You'll see instead of running locally, it's actually running in cloud. And it instantiates the same thing, picks up the image. And the behavior in cloud is exactly the same behavior as in Azure. One thing, if you just notice, I was still talking through it, is the page uploaded and this image came in later. This is exactly the behavior we want, which is you could upload hundreds of images. Your web front end gets decoupled from the image processing. That's the whole benefit of having worker roles talking to each other through queues. Whenever the images are ready, thumbnails are generated, you can start fetching them back into the web page. So that's the behavior here. Let's see what's going on with Visual Studio. It's still deploying, and this is typically a 5 to 7 minute process. And if you see, it starts creating a new instance of the application. Now, super hard to explain this using Visual Studio. So let's show you what's really going on behind the scenes. So I was in my local box, built an application. It made create a service package out of it, and I pushed it to the cloud, this big ethereal cloud, and runs around there for a while, figures out what to do, gets picked up by what's called the Fabric Controller. That's where the piece comes in, and very traditional deployment methods, you would take the application, deploy it to a server rack. That's pretty much what we do as well, except that we do it by spinning up instead of new hardware, new virtual machines. And these virtual machines are essentially part of a giant, giant data center. From your perspective, two machines are getting provisioned, one for your web role, one for your worker role, because a specified instance equal to one for each of them. And as soon as those machines are ready, as soon as the machines are ready, the actual application binaries get dropped onto those machines. So first, machine starts up, and then the machine gets sent the application that I just built, and the app code is ready at that point. The next step that happens is we need to make sure the right rules are set up so the external world can talk to it, right domain names are set up, and that's when the network load balancer comes in. You don't have to deal with it, but that's what's going on under the covers right now, which is it gets wired up correctly to make sure that external world can talk to my web role can talk to worker role. And once all this is done, my application's up and running. So this entire process is transparent to you. That's what happens on right-click publish. And at the end of it, you have an application up and running here. So let me show you. So this app is in a state where it's actually initializing and creating the hosts. That's what's going on. And while this is still doing, it's going to take about a few minutes. Let's just walk through a few other interesting concepts with the current cloud service. So one thing you would notice is I keep talking about scale, but I still have one server running my web role and one running my worker role. So one of the things you can do is, after the application has been deployed, you can go and on-demand increase how much scale you want. So what you do essentially is you take the instance count. Instead of one, let's put five servers. I want five for this. And I want, let's say, three of this. And this is the power by decoupling your web and your backends. You can essentially independently scale them. So you don't have to worry about keeping, you know, the counts in sync, making sure they're wired correctly. It doesn't matter anymore. As soon as you do this, the new configuration gets start getting pushed out to the service which is already deployed. So this is my existing service which is running. And dynamically, more machines start getting added. So actually, I should not wait for the next refresh. All righty. Okay. Cool. Just fetching the new state of the deployment. And now you have five worker roles serving my thumbnail processing, so I'm just quickly successful. And you start seeing new machines starting getting spun up. It takes roughly about three to four minutes for a machine to really spin up. And the good thing is it's 5 minutes no matter whether you go from 1 to 10 or whether you go from 1 from 100, because 100 machines get spun up in parallel. So let's go back to the deck, and let me explain what really happened here. So that's the whole concept of scale out and scale in. The fact that the application was designed to be stateless, we can dynamically scale up. You don't have to worry about my state has to be persisted, my data has to be flushed out. Those concepts don't apply. You don't have to worry about those. The whole application keeps the data in blob, and hence your application essentially is dynamically and elastically scalable. Under the covers, the interesting part is you don't have to specify what the second machine, third machine, fourth machine have to look like. Azure automatically clones these machines for you. So it already has the information it needs, which is which endpoints do you care about. Everything else gets wired up magically for you, where load balancer, routing, all that gets taken care of. So you don't have to worry about it. Essentially, it's just a whole bunch of extra clones, which is the whole notion of provisioning, allocation, buying, all that's taken care of. You don't have to worry about any of that. And what I just did through the portal, as a developer, you know, if you don't want to keep switching between doing it in a portal, you can always do it through Visual Studio as well. You can do it through an API. So all the operations that you see the portal doing are available as a REST API, so you can build your own tools. And of course, you can always use PowerShell as well. Actually, quick question. How many of you use PowerShell? A few. That's good feedback, because in terms of next set of big investments, we're wondering how much to invest towards PowerShell versus building more REST APIs. So How many of you would actually use REST APIs if they were available? A handful. How many of you would not use Windows Azure anyway? Okay. We should have that discussion. I think that's more hands than anything else. essentially, you know, what we did with the website was we just increased the instance count. And what this does really is it just keeps scaling the requirements as a instruction down to the fabric controller. And it spins up more and more instances. So whether you go from 2 to 6, or you actually go to, let's say, 92, essentially it's the same operation from your perspective. And in the giant data center, more and more machines get spun up on demand. So I usually love to show this slide. It kind of looks like a big robot there. Anyway. So, but, and, yes, there's a question there. Yes. Right. So the question was, I'll have to repeat the question for the video. Yes. So all machines, all instances are always identical. And that's the whole design, which is any one of those machines at any point can die. It doesn't matter. Each machine looks identical. However, everything that is in your CSCFG, which is the configuration file, can be changed after you've deployed the application. Anything which is in part of your CSDEF or the application is baked in, so you have to deploy a new version of the application. So essentially, through the portal, you can only change configuration. So things like connection strings, database connection strings. Those are things that you should always keep in your configuration file, never in the application package. So same principles. If you use app.config today or web.config, take stuff from there and put it in CSCFG, and you can keep changing it after deployment as well. And of course, you not only can scale up, we would love you to scale up, kind of make more money with that, but you can always scale down as well. That's the whole point. The most important point is, depending on what capacity you need is what you're paying for. So it's not that, you know, this morning I needed 100 servers, but this evening I only need 5. Every 1 hour, we look at how much compute capacity you really need, and you're paying at the 1 hour boundary at best of how much capacity you either scaled up to or scaled down to. So that's concept number two. So we looked at two concepts. One is, what is my application? What's my service definition, service config? That was a good question. How does scale up, scale down work? The third interesting concept to go look at is the whole notion of a fault and an upgrade domain. And essentially what that means is, you know, one machine can always die. Just remember that principle. One machine will not always die, it'll always will die. And hence, what Windows Azure does is it creates this notion of what is a single point of failure. And it could be either the entire rack that we just talked about, it could be a machine, it could be a process. And it makes sure that most of the common things that can fail are, you know, combined into a one single fault domain. And every application, the minute you have two instances, are guaranteed to be deployed across two fault domains. So that's something that, you know, just by the fact that you use two instances, the platform, the system gives you guarantees that they'll always be deployed across two clusters, two racks, two network switches, two storage controllers, two power units. You don't have to worry about that, but we have the logic in the Azure Fabric Controller to make sure that two parts of your application, which is identical, gets always split across two separate fault domains, so that if we detect that any one of them goes down, and there's a heartbeat that keeps running, you know, every 15 seconds, the minute we detect one of them goes down, the Fabric Controller automatically spins up a new instance, and because we already have the application code that you uploaded, it gets deployed, the new server comes up online, and gets automatically swapped out. So nothing that you have to worry about, just the fact that you specify two instances, Azure Controller, you know, deploys them across two fault domains. You can always specify more fault domains as well, if you're really, really worried, and you can always do geo-replication as well, but those are even more advanced concepts, we can get to that. But by default, just by having two instances, you get two fault domains automatically. And that's what helps us guarantee the 99.95% availability SLA with compute. The second concept, which is interesting, is the notion of an upgrade domain. And this is, you know, once I've built the application, I'm running it, it's very, very critical for me to make sure that my application never goes down. For that, Windows Azure gives you two different capabilities. One is a notion of web swap. We'll talk about that in a second. That's the reason why I had deployed my application, two applications, one to the production environment, which is running in production, and one to staging. And web swap would automatically let me swap between the two without any downtime. But the other one is the notion of an upgrade domain, which is a part of my application can get updated while the rest of the application is running. Let's see how that works. So let's assume you had an update for your application where you added a new module for doing Facebook signups in addition to doing basically only live ID signups. And the important part with upgrade domains with upgrading the application is you need to make sure that two versions of the application can run simultaneously against the same backend. If your architecture or if your application design takes care of that, then essentially the next version of the application can get deployed and upgraded at one upgrade domain at a time. What that does is it takes one instance out of production, puts a new set of bits there, puts it back into production, tests it. If it's working, that's when it brings it online and makes sure that, you know, both the versions are running successfully. And then it says, let's go ahead and upgrade the next upgrade domain. So at any given time, there's always one blue line connecting to your application, so your application is always available. And this is probably as advanced the functionality that I want to get into today's talk, if you're just doing basics, which is you can pretty much get zero downtime even through application upgrade itself. And it gets made possible by two things. One, if the applications are incremental in nature, the changes, you can upgrade them at one domain at a time. If they're completely different applications, you have the ability to do what's called a web swap. And let's talk about that part, which is Windows Azure gives you two identical environments for every application that you build. It gives you a production environment, it gives you a staging environment. The production environment essentially gets the fancy name of my service name. In this case, it was thumbnails. The staging environments just get a GUID. We don't want to start giving out too many names. So the web swap is a process by which we just deploy two versions and switch the network traffic going to the application instantaneously. So to your users, there's zero downtime because the next request that comes in automatically goes to the new version of it. Let's see how this works real quick. So you have the application. I have the thumbnails app running in production. I create the next version, and the next version gets deployed into what's called a staging environment. For all practical purposes, it looks identical. And whenever, as a developer, or my test team or my QA team is comfortable with the fact that this new application is running fine, all I have to do is click web swap, and it just starts routing the traffic instantaneously to the next, the newer version of the application. And of course, if for whatever reason you don't like the application, you can web swap back. So it's not that the application starts gone away. And this is pretty much what we do when we are rolling out newer versions of Azure itself. When we make a big change, we test it in a separate cluster. As soon as we're ready, we swap it, and you have the new version running instantaneously. So that's the other cool thing you can do with keeping your application up to date and not having to incur any downtime. So the big thing, the last 30 minutes, 35 minutes that we're talking about is, in all these cases, you're only dealing with my application versions, application upgrade, and not have to worry about how do I wire up my storage to talk to the storage controller or network load balancer. All that is abstracted from you. And I would love to hear feedback after the session or in Q&A if the level of control that you get is sufficient for most of your applications or if you need more control. But that we believe in most applications that as developers, whether you write a mobile application, talking to cloud, or you're writing a line of business application, with the ability to get full virtual machines, but run restricted code, you can run full trust code, but restricted kind of patterns, which is stateless, you can pretty much achieve all the things that we just talked about. So remember the five principles we talked about. Keep it stateless, make sure it's ready for scale out, make sure it's ready for redundancy, it's that important, and it's asynchronous. You do that, and we can guarantee you the rest. And that's the problem on the platform. So with that, I'll spend about 5-odd minutes. I don't want to spend too much time. There's a whole bunch of sessions which are going to talk about other building block services. We only talked about compute, which is what makes most of the application. But there are a whole bunch of other building block services that you get with Windows Azure. Everything from storage, highly reliable, highly scalable, highly available storage. You get other things like messaging, in addition to very basic queues that we just looked at, send a message, receive a message. You get other capabilities of PubSub, which is I send one message, hundreds of subscribers can get it. So if you're building a notification system, or you want to send out a notification of a breaking news, as an example, that's a great thing to use with Service Bus. You get everything from identity, access control, caching. So it's not just about this core compute. Core compute is where all the fancy availability and SLA is. But you get a lot of building blocks that you can quickly use to assemble your application as well. So as an example, we're going to dig deeper into storage for 5 minutes, and with that, I'll just stop and take Q&A at that point. You have a couple of different options in Windows Azure. You can use Blob storage. Blobs essentially is, think of it as an infinite file system for you. So you're used to writing to C drive, D drive. You don't have to worry about that. You write to a blob. A blob can be a 1 kilobyte size. It can be a terabyte size. It doesn't matter. So you don't have to worry about, how much the capacity is. Capacity gets created. Of course, there's a 10 terabyte limit. There's an upper limit. If you need more than 10 terabytes, please come talk to me. Would love to understand your application. But other than that, hopefully most blobs should fit in that. So whether it's videos, whether it's pictures, whether it's, just simple images and thumbnails that I'm keeping in this case, you can use a blob store. The best part about blob store is you don't have to pre-allocate or prepay anything. It's directly depending on your usage. So if you're uploading large video files, you pay for large video files. If suddenly you start uploading small video files, you just pay for small video. It's purely based on usage. It's not based on pre-allocation or capacity. SQL Azure is a fully relational. If you're used to SQL Server, for most part, SQL Azure looks similar. There's some quirks. You're fixing them. But for most part, SQL Azure is essentially SQL Server managed for you, running, so that you can actually build a traditional relational database application. And then there's, of course, the table storage, which is it's a key value pair. You know, there's a big move to the NoSQL world, where you just want to have key value, key value, key value, but you want to have millions and millions of entries to, you know, billions of entries possibly. Table storage is a classic way of keeping that kind of data, which is it's not structured. It's essentially just key value pair. Well, it's kind of structured, but it does not require the relational typical schemas, and hence it's, you know, a lot cheaper as well. So real quick, blob can also be directly exposed. So you don't have to worry about using compute to always write to blob. You can directly expose it. So for example, if you're building a phone application or a Slate application, you can directly talk to the blob and upload pictures. So you don't have to go through, upload a picture to, in our example, a web role pushes up, doesn't matter. The blobs can themselves be exposed at HTTP endpoints. And you have .NET client libraries, you have iPhone libraries, a whole bunch of samples available on Azure. They can use it. And in this example that we just took, the reason I'm talking about this, the thumbnail sample that I just talked about is actually available on WindowsAzure.com. So you can actually use the same sample, start working. Of course, it will not have my name in it. But other than that, it's the same application. What we really used from Windows Azure storage and communication was the blob store to keep the images and the thumbnails, as well as the queues to do asynchronous messaging. And that's pretty much what makes up the application. So I'm going to jump real quick, skip through some of the table and queues, but talk to you real quick about SQL. And one big difference between SQL Server and SQL Azure is you don't get to see the SQL Server, so it's all virtual server and a virtual database. We provision, we scale out, so you don't have to worry about how do you set up a, you know, replication between databases. All that's taken care of. But other than that, in terms of as a developer, the constructs that you're used to from a relational perspective and SQL engine, they pretty much equate as is for most applications, and we're getting to almost 100% parity, you know, with every release. So, with that, you'll have a couple more sessions. I think Nick is talking about how you do messaging, so you can build applications for mobiles, which heavily rely on asynchronous messaging. And there are a couple of other sessions on how do you use access control, CDN for caching, available online as well. But the whole bunch of building block services, and these keep getting added as we go on. And that's the second layer, which is high-level services on top of the core compute. So what I want to leave you with, you know, we covered, you know, for those of you, and a lot of you were not using Windows Azure, we covered everything from, you know, very, very basic, how do I just build an application pusher, to a lot of detailed concepts of upgrade domains and fault domains. If you don't remember any of it, doesn't matter. The things that really matter are the whole point of cloud is essentially to give you a self-service environment where you are no longer depending on an IT pro to buy servers or get capacity. Capacity is log onto the portal, get capacity, use it, scale up, scale down, shut it down. It's completely controlled by you. Windows Azure specifically, and hence a platform as a service. The whole goal is, as a developer, you don't have to deal with IT operations. You don't have to deal with management. You never have to worry about security patches getting installed to your machine or load balancing. That all gets taken care of you by the platform and the service itself. And as a result, if you actually follow the principles of building a simple cloud application, you get, you know, practically infinite scale, as long as infinite is less than a few hundred thousand. But you get infinite scale, you get elastic scalability, you get all the SLAs of uptime, and you get a lot of fancy controls to keep maintaining the uptime of your application, even when you have either 10 users or 100,000 users, or when you're maintaining the application on an ongoing basis. That's a very powerful construct by the fact that we can lock down on what control you have of the machines. And of course, the last part, which is, it's not about .NET. Of course, most of my app, you know, samples always use .NET, but you can run Node.js, you can run pick your application language of choice. You can build applications for Windows platform, or you can target iOS and Android, and there are a whole bunch of these samples. And essentially, you know, that's what Scott's talk is going to be about. My talk is more about what the concepts are. His talk is more about how do you get started, whether you are a .NET developer or whether you're not a .NET developer, it doesn't matter. Windows Azure is an open platform. Pick your language, pick your runtime, and we do the rest. So that's one message I want to leave you with, which is you can target any device, any application type, and you can build in any language you really care about, with small exceptions, but we keep adding that list there. So with that, we have about 4 minutes left. I want to open the floor for Q&A, and I know I'm between you and lunch, so I'll try to keep this short. But thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate that. No questions? Awesome. Oh, okay. Yes. Correct. So there are two parts of the question. One is, you know, you own the machine. You can pretty much remote desktop. Short answer is yes. And you can pretty much just, you know, come to the portal, pick the instance you care about, and right through the portal you can hit connect. And what it does is it downloads the remote desktop RDP file for you. And sitting here with the password I'd given during Visual Studio time, I can remote desktop into the server. So for all practical purposes, this is your server. For the lifetime, I think the password is... if it connects. Let's see if this comes up. So that's your machine. It's completely your machine. You can do whatever you want with it. The only thing to keep in mind is make sure you're not keeping state. So you're not coming into the remote desktop and configuring something, because the minute that machine dies, we will take your original state of the package and redeploy it. It's one thing to keep in mind. People love to do remote desktop, but do things for troubleshooting. It's not for configuration. Use CSCFG or the configuration files to do that. But yeah, for all practical purposes, this is your machine. You own it through the life cycle before it dies. Right.
If you install it on that machine, does it stay there?
Yes. So, perfect. Good question. Which is, if I was to rephrase that question, I want to have some custom, so of course I can always put application code, but if I want to install some custom drivers, custom application, how do I make sure that that state remains on the machine? That's where, you know, the whole notion, let me just hide this real quick. There's a notion of an entry point, and you can define what happens when a machine boots up. So, and this is what's the onStart method. The web role in this case was practically empty. There was nothing in this web role file, except for an empty method right now that's onStart. In this onStart method, you can write whatever code to run a command line, run a batch file, run some install. It can fetch data, fetch installs, install it. By putting the setup here of any external dependencies, you're guaranteed that even if you spin up 10 instances, 100 instances, one machine dies, and a new one comes in, this piece of code will always run on machine startup. And hence, your application or your machine will always start with the state you want it to be. So use this. Don't use remote desktop to do machine-specific or installation and configuration. One quick caveat. Make sure that whatever you write it on start does complete, because if it doesn't complete or it craps out here, it'll keep being in this infinite rolling state. So we see a lot of issues when you're debugging in on start. So on start is there's no remote desktop because the machine's still starting up. So just be careful. But other than that, you have full control over what you install on the machine. This method will run with full admin privileges. So you can install whatever you want. Good question. Time for one more question, and then I'll be available here later. The question is, would it be possible to run a SharePoint-based solution with this? So today, short answer is no, only because trying to use install SharePoint in an onStart method is really hard. But other than that, that feedback we've heard loud and clear. We're doing some stuff. You'll hear some announcements down the roadmap. We'll make that easier. The second thing is, if you're using SharePoint from Office 365 as an example, there are a lot of things you can do by, you know, you extend Office 365 by doing custom methods, custom applications, and just extend your base SharePoint, which gets run for you, managed by you, for you, and then you call for specific custom methods, custom workflows into a Windows Azure application. So that's how most customers extend SharePoint today, where custom computing happens or custom code happens in Azure, and base SharePoint login and everything happens on Office 365. But that being said, we're looking at how do we make SharePoint run better in Azure as well. So with that, I'm getting a warning that I'm 35 seconds over. So thank you again, and I'll be available after this for the questions. Thanks.